You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Artificial intelligence has been described as the new electricity poised to revolutionize human life. But AI has also been described as our biggest existential threat. Should we welcome intelligent machines or fear them? On Tuesday, November 12th, at The Lensic, researcher and award-winning author Melanie Mitchell will describe the current state of AI, both its stunning achievements and its surprising failures. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Reserve your free tickets at ticketssantafe.org or call 988-1234. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is once again accepting scholarship applications, and Northern New Mexico residents are invited to apply. Deadline for undergraduate scholarships is the 21st of January, 2020. Deadline for Career Pathways Scholarships in support of two-year degrees, certificates, and trades is November 17th, 2019. Criteria and application for both may be found at lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. I'm happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Mark Winnie. His new book is Food Town USA, Seven Unlikely Cities That Are Changing the Way We Eat. He's author of several books. He's also a senior advisor to the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. And he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday, the 14th of November at 6 o'clock in the evening, joined by Rebecca Barron-Reese, director of MoGrow, the mobile grocery, right here in Santa Fe. Welcome.
Great to be back here. Thanks.
Yeah, good to have you back. This is such an interesting book. It's about this varied group of places, cities, small to large, large-ish in the United States, that you wouldn't necessarily think of as being leaders in standing up to our unsustainable food system. How did you choose these seven cities?
Well, it's the first question everybody asks, and I wouldn't say it was a rigorous or scientific process, but I pretty much was looking for a range of places that were not on the typical foodie radar. You know, they weren't Berkeley or Brooklyn or Boulder. And I wanted also a geographic diversity. I wanted size diversity. So, you know, doing the seven cities, and I'd be happy to list them off for you, Portland, Maine, not Portland, Oregon, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Youngstown, Ohio, Jacksonville, Florida, Boise, Idaho, Sitka, Alaska, and Alexandria, Louisiana. So they're all
tired already. Just
I know.
Flying
well,
and driving
just imagine
around.
Imagine me like having to get around to all these places. But yeah, it was actually exciting and fun, and they are all quite different. But I think the thing that I really was looking for is, you know, what is going on in these places that might suggest that good food has become the new normal, not just in those, you know, big B cities, but in other places like Boise and Jacksonville and so forth. And also, what were the common denominators between them, you know, and what are the common denominators between them and other cities that we do think of as being kind of, you know, hotshot, sexy food cities?
Well, when you talk about food, and this is something that the book is about, you're also talking about wealth and poverty, big and small business, climate, economic development, racism, demographics, you know, changes in demographics. And, you know, that's more than food. And one thing that I think is interesting is you're kind of busting this myth that the desire for fresh and healthy food is somehow elitist. Tell us what you're seeing.
That's exactly right. I mean, I have grown tired over the years of since I've been a foodie myself for probably going on 50 years. The idea that eating well, eating locally, eating sustainably, paint just considering the fact that food is medicine, that these are all elitist assumptions or elitist notions. And I grow a little tired of that argument. And when I go out to other places that aren't considered to be, again, you know, cool food places, you find that good food is available everywhere. People are conscious of the same issues. And maybe that's not surprising to a lot of people anymore, but I really feel that, you know, it totally blows apart the myth of elitism and food when you start to think about, you know, being able to get good coffee anywhere, getting good beer anywhere, finding farm-to-table restaurants, finding that, you know, people even eating in very sort of low to moderate circumstances, income-wise, are paying attention to what they eat and where it's coming from. And I found that very exciting.
Well, I mean, with great respect, coffee and beer are not exactly food groups, right? And farm-to-table restaurants...
one of my important groups.
Well, yeah, no, I know. I mean, salt, sugar, caffeine, but, you know, it remains that farm-to-table restaurants still tend to be expensive. What are you seeing that's really serving low-income people with respect to fresh, healthy, and even local food?
Well, one of the things that I was looking for here, I mean, I was looking for two things. One was that I wanted to find places where people are paying attention to good food and locally grown food and so forth. But at the same time, I wanted places where people were paying attention to those who weren't eating that well, who were limited by their income or limited by poor access, you know, so-called food deserts, not having sufficient places to shop. What I was looking for in that case is, what are the communities themselves doing about those situations? I mean, how are they taking care of their own? It was a term that I decided to use, taking care of our own, meaning that everybody should be able to participate in this good food system. And I think, you know, one piece of evidence around that, something I saw in all the places I went, was some way to incentivize lower income shoppers, particularly people involved in the SNAP or food stamp program, in their local farmers market. So everyone should be able to eat locally. Everybody should be able to get the best local fresh produce available, regardless of price. And I mean, it's a program and that's obviously very popular here in New Mexico, northern New Mexico. You find almost all the farmers markets participate in that program. Well, that was pretty much the case everywhere. And if there weren't, sometimes the funding from that would come from different places. It wasn't just the federal government. Sometimes it was local government as well. So there was a very keen interest in making sure that those who are the biggest advocates of local food and healthy food also were involving and engaging lower income communities.
And one of the things that you saw and that we see all around the country, you wrote about it specifically with respect to Louisiana, you went to a place called Alexandria, Louisiana, was that, I mean, we all probably, most of our listeners know that a lot of farm subsidies go to what amounts to junk food, processed carbohydrate and sugar rich foods that are not good for you, but they're cheap. And so as a result, where there's the lowest income, there's the highest obesity, which on the face of it seems paradoxical, but those foods are so unhealthy, they're empty calories. So how are people, take Louisiana, what are they doing there specifically to look at obesity and the relationship to healthy food?
Well, they approached it in a very interesting way. They saw their food system as an opportunity to also grow their economy. You know, this also became sort of a universal trait, not perhaps brought to the level, high level that it was in Alexandria, but certainly as something that has become more common. And so they said, well, if we're going to strengthen our economy, and in central Louisiana, where Alexandria is, they need to do that. They have a very high poverty rate. They don't have a great selection. They don't have a robust economy. So one way they wanted to diversify was to make sure that you know, local farmers, local food businesses, restaurants, coffee shops, and so forth were very much a part of their economic development strategy. In fact, the agency that was in charge of developing the economy within a 10-parish or 10-county region had three people assigned just to food development. So it was everything from starting farmers markets to working on policy issues that would improve the selection and availability of healthy food, particularly as part of a larger health initiative that was going on throughout Louisiana. You know, they have one of the highest obesity and diabetes rates in the country. And then, you know, it's very concerning. So they looked at policy. How can we improve the quality of food at the same time that we can give farmers new access to healthy food? I went, for instance, to the food bank that served that area, and they had one of the most dynamic gardening programs that I've ever seen.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I've never seen a food bank be so out there, and so and make gardening such a big part of their program.
And a community part, like people are participating in it.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, and they were responsible for developing over 70 garden sites across their area, their central Louisiana area. And this was directly related to the fact that as a food bank, they're not always getting donated food that's of the best quality and best nutrition and the healthiest stuff available. So they realized that what they had to do was encourage people to grow their own. And they were doing it, and they were doing it successfully. So making gardening an integral part of the emergency food system in that area was a really important and productive and healthy way for them to proceed.
They also had this, what did you call it, one-stop shopping, where you could go to the food bank and get your health insurance and a couple of other things.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, it was, and that's another thing. I mean, keep in mind, you know, impoverished people, you know, they're feeling desperate. They're feeling, you know, it's a mother usually with two or three children in tow. Children not really happy about all the being dragged around. Often they're relying on public transportation. So they go into the food bank and they can not only get some food to get them through for the next week or so, they can also get help in applying for health insurance. They can get help in applying for SNAP or food stamp benefits. They may decide that this is a good opportunity for them to get involved in gardening. So all this, these sort of wraparound services, you might say, are a much more effective way of trying to meet people's needs than simply giving them food.
Exactly.
While that's important, they need all these other services in order to be able to have a sustainable and prosperous life.
And that brings up a question that I think is a really interesting and important one to discuss, and that is, on the one hand, you've got a lot of individual initiative and entrepreneurship, which you talk about in the book. On the other hand, you have a lot of government participation and striking the right balance so that on the one hand, it's not over-bureaucratized, and on the other hand, it's not capital poor, is kind of the task at hand.
That's right. It is a partnership. It's between the public sector and the private sector, and there is a balance. I make the point that when government becomes a little too overbearing and tries to sort of dictate the direction that a community ought to go, people push back, and it's just not as effective. But when you have entrepreneurs, and when I talk about entrepreneurs, I'm talking about nonprofit social entrepreneurs as well as for-profit entrepreneurs. Anybody who has ideas and some investment and some energy they want to put into of developing something new, involving local government to enable those new ideas to come forward and to create a more supportive overall, governmental support, eliminating barriers perhaps, to, or at least reducing barriers to entering the marketplace with a new food business. And food being, a particular concern when it comes to sanitation and health, these things all have to be accounted for, of course, but it can be very onerous, or it can, we can help you get your business started.
So it's not just capital, it's proper regulation.
That's right.
And it's not, and that's the thing, like you talked about Boise, Idaho, where it's a state that's very, very Republican, very rural. Boise is kind of like a blue dot in the red state to some extent. And this question of what is the right amount of economic development and regulation is playing out there.
It's a fascinating place because it was almost this irony where, in one sense, a state like Idaho doesn't want any regulation. The city of Boise passed a bill to ban plastic bags. Well, then the state of Idaho came in and with what was called a preemption and said, you, a city, does not have the right to ban plastic bags. So it sets up this sort of, ideological battle. But on the other hand, having sort of a low regulatory barriers makes it easier for businesses to get started. So it was an incredible proliferation of small businesses. There were, 12 new hard cider labels were launched in just 1 year. And most of them are coming into the farmer's market. Now, the farmer's market is a great place to showcase new local food products. And so everybody wanted, but in the farmers market is supported very much by a sort of a community and city partnership. But it's interesting to see that having just the right amount, what is just the right amount of regulation that enables, I think the other part of it isn't just regulation, it's also the fact that in a place like Boise, you had a community that was very committed to raising the quality of life for everybody. And there was a very important association between certain kinds of food activities and a quality of life. I mean, it attracted certain kinds of people. It brought in more professional folks. It definitely raised the income levels of the overall community. But at the same time that they're doing that, that they're trying to improve the quality of life through a more exciting food scene, for instance, they're also paying attention to their own. To, you know, they're taking care of their own. They're trying to bring along everybody else at the same time. But again, going back to this balance between government and, you know, the public sector and the private sector, you know, it's one you got to, sometimes people have to sort of play around with it to get it right. But, you know, if people have the idea that, you know, we want to do everything we can to, you know, make our economy work, to promote sustainability and to engage and involve everyone who lives here, you know, we can't have too many barriers, but at the same time, we have to ensure public safety, public health, and so forth.
You spoke a moment ago about social entrepreneurship. You also used the word social capital. What do those terms mean? I mean, social capital is something that you write about having sort of eroded over the last several decades.
Yeah, social capital kind of comes a term. I think the inventor was Robert Putnam, who's a Harvard sociology professor who wrote the book Bowling Alone, where, you know, he looked at what is going on in communities where people are no longer doing things together, but they're now doing things on their own. So he found, just as that title suggests, more people are bowling, but they're not bowling in clubs. They're not all wearing their bowling shirts and having their names printed on them anymore. They're all going out there on their own. So, but that kind of behavior, it has sort of pervaded so much of our community life. And what's important, it's not so much important when it comes to bowling, but it's really important when, you know, we as a community decide, how are we going to do something? How are we going to solve problems? Are we going to try to do it completely as individuals? Or are we going to try to work in associations and groups? And what we find is that, you know, the more closer people are together, you know, the higher the level of social capital, people take care of themselves better, they take care of their neighbors better, they're more engaged in things like voting. And when social capital erodes, you know, the opposite occurs, and that is to the detriment of communities. Now with food is a great way to promote social capital. You know, what is more social than going, say, to a farmer's market? What's more social than sitting down with friends and having dinner, or, you know, preparing a meal together? You know, so food is a great way to promote social capital. What I like about, and what I sort of discovered in the course of doing my research is, you know, the individual really matters, which almost sounds like it's the opposite of social capital. But I find that the idea that an individual comes up with an idea, they want to stick their neck out, they want to make an investment in a restaurant, in a brew pub, in a cafe, but in also in a nonprofit organization or a public initiative that's going to increase the availability of benefits for people who want to shop at a farmer's market, they're not just doing it on their own, they're doing it with the support of the community. You know, there's sort of I came up with this term, community-supported entrepreneurship. So it's not just me being like the, you know, the lone wolf with a great idea to come out there and do something on my own, like a lot of our sort of dot-com, entrepreneurs do. These are people that look for a sanctioning from the community, something that says we are behind you and we really want your business and your idea to succeed. And perhaps the best evidence of this was in, of all places, Sitka, Alaska, where I went. And they had something they called Planning Day. And on Planning Day, once a year, all day on Saturday, a couple hundred people come, and they, with their own ideas about how to improve the community, and they go through a whole process. And then at the end of the day, two or three of the ideas rise to the surface, and everyone says, yes, these are the things we want to support. And they've been doing this for 10 years. And over that period of time, about 60% of all the projects that they hatched out of the course of planning day were food or farm related. And they'd put a little bit of money into it. People would volunteer. Everybody would get behind it in some way.
And Sitka, Alaska is such an interesting example because you have to like stretch your mind to imagine farms there. There are farms there. There's not as much fresh produce maybe as one would hope for. So much of it is imported from the mainland, from the lower 48. And they're responding to overfishing and climate change. So it's a really different Sitka than it was a generation ago.
It's really challenging and really interesting. They have the highest prices, highest food prices in the United States, with the exception of a few places that are in Alaska that are even more remote than Sitka. You can only get there by boat or plane. There's no roads into Sitka. And yes, you're surrounded by this incredibly rich and abundant ocean and marine life, and people are fishing all the time, and it probably has the highest consumption of fresh fish in the U.S. But of course, there's a huge commercial fishing presence as well. And then even more concerning, there's a huge foreign fishing fleet that comes in and really scoops up a lot of the fish. And even though it's a very highly regulated fisheries, they've seen continuing declines in different species. They had to close down some of the more iconic salmon runs, like the Copper River, when I was there a year ago, was not open at all. The more people I talked to, from scientists to fishermen to the elders in the Sitka tribe, everyone has reached a consensus from a different methodology, you might say, that the waters are warming, the species are declining, and that there is indeed a real threat.
And meanwhile, school children don't necessarily get fresh fish because it's going to the commercial market, which is crazy.
Right. Though in Sitka, first time I ran into a fish to school program. Many people are now familiar with farm to school.
Farm to table, farm to school.
Farmers selling right into our public schools. We have a great program in Santa Fe and throughout New Mexico. But in Sitka, the fishermen came together with the support of a nonprofit organization, and working with the head of food service for the Sitka schools, they were buying at a very low cost. Otherwise, even as close as the fish are to this, they're literally only a couple of hundred yards away from the ocean, the schools wouldn't be able to afford the salmon that was caught in those waters because of the higher prices that the fishermen were getting. So they were able to work out a deal where they were able to bring the price down. The fishermen would donate a little bit. There's a little bit of subsidy, and then the school picked up the balance. So kids were getting, great fish right off the docks. And that's another sort of example of how we take care of our own. How do we use our local resources, our local talent, our local sort of know-how, and solve certain problems that we have?
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We'll be back in just a moment. Support for the Radio Cafe comes from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a reading and conversation by Dr. Eve L. Ewing with Wayne Au on Wednesday, November 13th at 7 o'clock at the Lensic. Writer and sociologist Dr. Eve L. Ewing, an assistant professor at the University of Chicago, creates multiple genres and forms: academic writing and scholarship, teaching, cultural organizing, poetry, comic book, and fiction. Her research is focused on the impact of racism, social inequality, and urban policy on American public schools and young people. She is the author, most recently, of the poetry collection 1919, the nonfiction work Ghosts in the Schoolyard, Racism and School Closings on Chicago's South Side, and the Ironheart series for Marvel Comics. Tickets available at the Lensic, 988-1234, or lensic.org. Another thing that you're showing us in the book is kind of like what grows from the rubble of industrial America when those industries leave. You go to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and Youngstown, Ohio, both former industrial capitals that took a huge downturn. What's going on there? What are some of the cool, interesting food things? What are some of the challenges?
Yeah, Bethlehem Pennsylvania and Youngstown, Ohio. In a way, you could pair them off. You know, same problem. They both were victims of the collapse of the U.S. steel industry. First in the late 70s in Youngstown, and then later on in the 90s in Bethlehem. And we're talking tens of thousands of people out of work, sometimes a matter of days, or sometimes it was stretched out over a couple of years. But these places' identity was associated with steel, and these huge stacks and furnaces. And Bethlehem Steel, you know, made 1,300 warships during World War II. I mean, these places go way back. And when that industry ended, they had to come up with a new identity. They had to figure out who they are, but they also had to figure out how to provide jobs, how to live, how to earn a living. And in the case of Bethlehem, they used food as part of that solution. They said, all right, you know, what can we do that would, you know, stimulate our economy? Now, they went through sort of the entertainment phase with casinos. They also made art a very big part of their revitalization strategy. But food kind of worked its way both into entertainment and into the arts. And so when they were trying to figure out how do we redevelop this area, well, one of the solutions they came up with was a lot of little restaurants that would be owned by local people, so-called ethnic restaurants. And just in this one small section of Bethlehem, there's over 50 ethnic restaurants, and they represent all the identities of the people that live there. There's El Salvadorian, there's Peruvian, there's Puerto Rican. And then there are food festivals, too, a very dominant part of their revitalization strategy. And then, of course, they did some of the other more, what we might consider traditional today, which was establishing farmers markets, how do we support the development of farmers and getting more locally produced food into our schools and into our communities in different ways. So they did a lot to protect farmers, to work with farmers and help farmers, but they were doing at the same time they were helping this community that was really down on its luck after the death of Big Steel. Now Youngstown is sort of a different story. Same problem, same cause of its economic failure, but nobody came to the rescue in the case of Youngstown, and they just took a very lackadaisical attitude toward it. To me, it looked as if the fault was that of the state government, just didn't step up and try to rescue this city. And it's one big food desert. You couldn't find a supermarket in the entire city of Youngstown. The infant mortality rate for black families was among the highest in the country. The homicide rate was off the charts. It was just a whole litany of huge problems. However, two things were happening. People were using food to try to bring back that community, farmers markets, gardens, a big incubator project there where people were, you know, food processing and so forth was going on. And then the other thing that was happening was the effort to try to help young people come back to Youngstown. There was a whole effort called Returning Citizens. How do we nurture, you know, these young people who have left, and they left when Youngstown was just hitting the bottom, and how do we encourage them to come back? Well, one thing they did is they had a huge stock of cheap housing. They had homes that were going for $10,000 or even $15,000. And so young people were buying those homes and returning to Youngstown. But oftentimes they were young people who were very much involved in food projects. You know, they were starting food businesses, they were starting gardens, and there was a lot of vacant land in the city because so much housing had been lost. So food was very much a part of their attempt to bring back a city that was definitely still going through some very, very hard times. So I'd say you'd have to say that the jury's still out on whether or not Youngstown is going to make it. But if they began to think a little bit more like Bethlehem, I'd say their chances of success would be much higher.
One of the questions that comes up for me and for anybody, I mean, it's classic when you have, whether it be an entire city or a neighborhood within a city, and you start getting craft breweries and nice coffee shops and decent restaurants, it's the sign of gentrification. Is gentrification a problem in some of these places that you visited? You know, as a result of all the things that we're trying to do, which is have economic development and nicer neighborhoods.
You know, that question has come up often, and I think that it gets presented as sort of an either-or proposition, and it definitely is not. I mean, it does, because we have, you know, craft breweries or some, you know, cool coffee shops, doesn't mean that the neighborhood is going to go into hell. You know,
but you quoted yourself. People are saying, "There goes the neighborhood."
When I did that as a joke. It's like, yeah. Like if you're living in this neighborhood your whole life, and all of a sudden there's, you know, all these yuppies showing up, getting, you know, walking around with cappuccinos and lattes, you say, "Oh my God, there goes the neighborhood," right? But, you know, and that with the concern, the real concern being that, you know, rents are going to go up, and you know, the demographics are going to change and create all kinds of, you know, social and economic issues. It's like you need both. You need a parallel development process that says, all right, food can be a good part of a revitalization strategy. But in the case of Bethlehem, as I said, you know, they looked at existing families who are living in these neighborhoods who had existing food skills, like they could prepare, you know, a little bit of help and a little bit of technical support, a little bit of capital investment. They will open up a restaurant. And it wasn't a high-end restaurant. It was not elitist. And just down the block, you can find 10 local beers on tap that weren't there 10 years ago. That's attracting a slightly different crowd, but both people are going back and forth. You know, they're learning. It begins to, very slowly begins to reduce the social barriers, including some of the racial barriers that exist in communities. The food does have a way of bringing people together. I think I made the case, I think the contrast was most evident in Jacksonville, Florida, which is the largest city I went to. It has a very large black community. For the most part, the city's largest food desert is also the city's black community. And there's not a single supermarket in an area which is a very large section of Jacksonville. And at the same time, you saw this incredibly vibrant food scene developing across the city of Jacksonville. So I was really curious, so what's going on here and what's going on in this other part of town, on the black side of town, which is called the north side? And I found a very vibrant food scene in the north side. And it was just as vibrant in its own way as what was going on elsewhere. But it had been almost ghettoized. It had been sort of segregated unintentionally by, you know, the poor part of town attracted people who could, where it was more affordable, and that's where the African American community was living. But now there was a strong effort to try to bring back some supermarkets into that community and also raise up some of the culinary traditions that were unique to that community. And as I was sort of going back, and it almost felt like I was crossing this line at points. It was almost like the Berlin Wall or something, going from one side to the next, and finding that people were beginning to talk to each other about how to develop a more common approach and a more supportive and mutually supportive approach to each other's businesses, and not treat them as sort of separate. You know, oh, that's where the black people eat, and oh, that's where the white people eat. And there was the early stages of a coming together. Again, it pointed to me as to what the power of food can be. You know, it can, it allows you to take some baby steps and then some bigger strides toward healing some of those racial divides.
So what did you actually see? I mean, people eating together, people sharing culinary skills.
There were black chefs and there were white chefs who, for the first time, were actually talking to each other about joint ventures, maybe they would collaborate on a food festival that was coming up. They might be in the early stages of talking about opening up a new restaurant together. The city itself was, for the very first time, starting to look at what it could do to invest in the food side of its economy, and particularly how could it bring some supermarkets into the lower income parts of the city, which were as I said, food deserts. And part of this was aided by just the growing awareness. There was a African-American woman whose name is Jacoby Pittman, who runs this big mission organization, right? Homeless shelters and meal programs and job training programs in Jacksonville. She was appointed and then elected later to the Jacksonville City Council. And she has made it her task, her main purpose in life to try to bring good food to the north side of Jacksonville. And so as a result, you're seeing more public investment going into food in an area, part of town, which has been neglected for a long time. Now, you know, I don't want to sugarcoat any of this as I talk about it. There was a lot of racism. I mean, there's stories that I was hearing, you know, make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. And I tell some of those stories in my book. You know, there's a long way to go before people are going to, like, come together around this. And I'm not suggesting that we're anywhere near a group hug when it comes to food and some of these communities that have been traditionally divided by black and white. But I was seeing some progress taking place. And this was, you know, based on the observations of people who had been living there for a long time.
You're talking about food as a driver for economic development. If mayors and city councilors want to start thinking about incorporating food into their economic development plans, how do they start? I mean, it has to be presumably a community-based initiative that includes entrepreneurs and chefs and gardeners and farmers and whatever.
Well, fortunately, I've had the chance to do some of this work in Santa Fe, and some of the work that the Santa Fe Food Policy Council did, I think it was a little over a year ago. You know, we looked at what the economic value was of our food economy, and we found that it was almost $1 billion for Santa Fe County, 150,000 people, almost $1 billion worth of activity, food-related activity. That's a lot. So when city officials and both elected and appointed start to think more intentionally about the contribution that food can make to the economy, I think you start to see better results. I mean, they acknowledge, first of all, that there is this value, economic value of food. And so they start to think, well, what about the dollars that we have now with which we're buying food for schools or prisons or hospitals or other public institutions? I said, how can we use more of that money to buy it from local producers, vendors, distributors, bakers, coffee roasters? Some of the work that was done, I used this example in the book, by former state auditor Tim Keller, who's now mayor of Albuquerque, that showed that if, you know, you started to shift a much larger percentage of the public procurement dollar to locally owned food businesses, you would have a huge impact on the economy. I mean, just coffee. If all governments across New Mexico bought all their coffee from local roasters, it would add $1 million to their economy and 32 new jobs. Now, that's just one item. And I, you know, multiply that times all the different products. Now, and we're not just talking locally grown food farmers, but we're talking about other food businesses. I think the power of food to sort of raise up the cultural identity of a community, to tell the story of who we are, is very powerful. And that, you know, all the events that can be sort of associated, you know, public events and festivals and so forth, that local government can support, you know, need to make sure that food is a big part of it, and it's local food, and it's food that does help us to understand our identity and gives local vendors a chance to sell into those events.
Not to mention, I mean, when you're talking about hospitals, schools, prisons, some of our most vulnerable people in our society, and they're eating disgusting, unhealthy junk. Yeah. I mean, you have a lot of benefits that don't even, you know, that aren't even factored into that equation, like perhaps over the long run, lower healthcare costs.
I know. I mean, if I come up with one reason that I haven't committed any crime, it's because I know that I wouldn't want to eat the food that I'd get in prison.
Yeah, it's good to know what your motives are.
Yeah, I know. I mean, not that I have had a lot of opportunity, but it continues to dishearten me, and I know a lot of people when they look at the food they get served, and you know, to people who are incarcerated, and you know, the amount of money that we spend on that. So I think, you know, the point is a good one, that we're not just looking at, you know, food as an economic development engine. We're looking at food as the nutrient value, its health value. You know, food is medicine is a very important mantra that I think we need to incorporate into everything we do, both in our public life and our private life. So we need to look, we need to keep that in mind. And that refers to the least among us. It refers to people in prison. It refers to the lowest income people in our communities.
Children
and elderly. And we're, you know, we continue to neglect that. You know, we sort of pay attention to it. We sort of pay respect every now and then to the fact that, you know, lower income people are, and other vulnerable groups, you know, need to eat better than they do. But we haven't put the kind of public energy into that that we need to.
I have to ask you, in your travels to these seven cities all across the country, what were some of the outstanding meals that you ate or things that you ate and drank?
In Sitka, Alaska, I tell a story about it. I was there early in July, and it was the first day of the opening of their farmers market, which only has about an 8 or 9 week season because of the climate. It started at 10 o'clock. I showed up about 10:30, and I got the last head of lettuce that was available that day. But I also found something called it looks like a very skinny asparagus, and it grows right at the high tide mark on the beach, and it's very similar to asparagus. And so I got that. I got some fresh salmon, and I cooked this all myself. So I had salmon right off the boat. I had fresh cut beach asparagus, and right outside my window of my Airbnb there were salmon berries. They were these beautiful orange fat berries that look like raspberries, but they're orange, bright orange. I picked them right from my window. That was actually the best meal I had.
Wow.
And I hadn't never cooked beach asparagus before in my life. So, but other than that, I really enjoyed places like Fegley's Brew Works in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, you know, which is a great story about a very entrepreneurial guy that started when Bethlehem was at the absolute bottom of its economic existence around the year 2000. Everything was closing. I mean, Main Street was just shuttering all the windows and doors, and he decided he's going to open up a restaurant. Probably the stupidest thing anybody could imagine, but he now employs 200 people. He sources most of his food from local sources. You know, he brews his own beer. The spent grain goes to a rancher who feeds it to his cows, who in turn are bought by Mr. Fegley and turned into hamburger.
So it's kind of not quite a closed loop, but
almost. And you know that. So I'm eating this great hamburger and a great IPA in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, thinking about the story behind the food. And I think that's maybe that part that I try to capture in the book, is the story here. It's a story about, you know, these acts of sustainability, but also what are the economic impacts? What's the history of somebody taking a risk to do something that any banker in the world would have told them not to do? And how many people it employs, and what the impact now is on that, in that community. And I'm sitting in Fegley's Brew Works, and I'm looking around, and there's almost an equal number of brown people and black people and white people eating in this restaurant all at the same time. So, you know, there's something special going on, and I don't want people to necessarily make the biggest deal in the world about it, but I don't think we should be taking it for granted either. I think we should need to be acknowledging all the different attributes that our food system and our food supplies to us, you know, all that really do enhance our quality of life.
Well, you've spent many years, like really your entire career, I think, working on food issues. At this point, what's giving you hope? What's also giving you the most concern and worry?
Well, I'll start with the hope, which I think is that good food is the new normal, I think. I mean, that may be sticking my neck out a little bit, but I certainly saw it in places that I would not expect to see it. And I think that this is going to grow. I think that's really going to happen. I think we're going to see more entrepreneurs coming in and doing this kind of work. The other part was the millennials. I like the fact that we have so many younger people. I have my son is a millennial, you know, returning to the places where they grew up and starting businesses or starting social projects or becoming involved in public policy initiatives. That's giving me a tremendous amount of hope. So I kind of see this coming together of community revitalization, younger people, and a more supportive, larger community that's much more supportive than it used to be. The thing that gives me worry, I think number one is going to be climate change, followed closely by the continuing income and wealth inequality in this country, and the continuation of racism as a major factor. So these divides that are income and race based are very concerning. And climate change, I was seeing it. I saw it firsthand. I saw it in Jacksonville, how, the hurricanes had wiped out neighborhoods, whole neighborhoods, to the point that they decided they're not going to rebuild those neighborhoods because it's going to happen again. And in Sitka, Alaska, where the salmon catch and the herring runs are much lower than they used to be. And the only thing I see as promising is in terms of addressing those problems are going back to the hope that people can come together and work together and begin to and see how important food is in both helping us to reduce those inequalities, reduce the racial divides, and also try to mitigate at least the impact of climate change.
Mark Winney's new book is Food Town USA, 7 Unlikely Cities That Are Changing the Way We Eat. He will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday, November 14th at 6 in the evening, joined by Rebecca Baron Reese, who is director of MoGrow, the mobile grocery right here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. It was great.
And the Radio Cafe would like to thank its sponsors, the Santa Fe Institute, the Lannan Foundation, the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, the Lensic Performing Arts Center, and Southwest Care. Thank you so much for making this program possible. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.